This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. John DeGatta is a widely published writer and a well-respected professor. He wrote an essay about a suicide in Las Vegas, sent it to Harper's Magazine, but Harper's rejected the essay because it was filled with inaccuracies. John sent his essay to a magazine called The Believer, and that's a magazine that's pretty clear about its submission policy. It says, please do not send fiction. The Believer gave the article to an intern named Jim Fingle. It was Jim's job to fact-check the essay. Jim was fresh out of college and new to publishing. He was also unpaid. Digging up inaccuracies in John's essay took him 6 months and resulted in more pages of commentary than the essay itself. The back and forth between fact-checker Jim and writer John is now the basis for a new book, The Lifespan of a Fact. John DeGatta and Jim Fingle join me today. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you here. John, this essay is about a young man named Levi Presley who committed suicide in Las Vegas. Why did you want to write about this?
Well, I was in Las Vegas at the time it happened, and I first became interested in his story because I first thought that I had a connection to it. I was living in Las Vegas doing research on another book, and I was also living with my mom, who had just moved to Las Vegas, so I was helping her settle. And she had suggested volunteering for the local suicide hotline, which is something she had done before. She thought I may find it interesting. So I did, and I went through the training. And my very first night of volunteering, I received a call from a young-sounding person. I didn't have his name. I didn't know where he was other than Las Vegas. And we talked very briefly, but he didn't really say very much and ended up hanging up on me. And I probably could have dismissed the call because, as I quickly learned, you get a lot of hang-ups on a suicide hotline. But that same night after my shift ended, I was watching TV with my mom, and there was a report of a boy who killed himself by jumping off the top of the Stratosphere Hotel, which is the tallest building in Las Vegas, actually the tallest building west of the Mississippi. And possessing the kind of brain that I have, I immediately convinced myself that I had spoken to this boy, that he is the unnamed person who called me earlier that night. And so all while I was in town researching this other book, I started trying to find out who this boy was who called me and who Levi was and whether, in fact, they were the same person.
So this... Go ahead.
Well, and the deeper I looked into Levi's story, the more I learned about not just his suicide, but suicide in general in Las Vegas. And I learned what I think not many people in Las Vegas or certainly the country know, which is that more people kill themselves in Las Vegas than anywhere else in the country. And that's what really turned me on to trying to tell Levi's story and the story of this epidemic in Las Vegas.
So you have a kind of a quintessential elements for journalism. First of all, a very personal connection, which isn't necessary for journalism, but there's this personal connection. There's this kind of zeitgeist out there, the story of suicide and how prevalent it is in a place as fabulous as Las Vegas, and then in a very particular story. So that's the story. That's the grist. Jim, then you're the fact checker. You're given the assignment of fact checking the essay that results from this. Were you surprised at the number of inaccuracies?
Well, I guess I was not surprised that there were inaccuracies because the essay had been submitted to The Believer, I think, with the full understanding that of its sort of backstory and that it had some things that had been factual content that had been changed or streamlined.
Oh, the backstory included being rejected by Harper's for the very that very reason, right? Did
yes.
you know that?
I knew that when it was submitted, and it was presented actually as something that, you know, maybe we would find there were 5 or 10 things that had been changed, and when we published the essay, that could be noted in the front matter of the magazine, or something like that. But as I dug into fact-checking the essay, it turned out there were more than 5 or 10 things that I came across.
All right. Well, I tell you what, to give us a sense then of the kind of correspondence, the back and forth between you as the fact-checking goes on, maybe I can ask you to read from the book, The Lifespan of a Fact, and it's pretty close to the beginning of the book.
Sure. Hi, John. I'm Jim Fingal. I'm the intern who's been assigned to fact-check your article about Las Vegas, and I've discovered a small discrepancy between the number of strip clubs you're claiming there are in Las Vegas and the number that's given in your supporting documents. I'm new at this, so bear with me. I was hoping that you could clarify how you determined that there are 34 strip clubs in the city while the source you're using says 31.
Hi, Jim. I think there might be some sort of miscommunication because the article, as you call it, is fine. It shouldn't need a fact checker. I have taken some liberties in the essay here and there, but none of them are harmful, and I've actually been assuming that everyone was cool with what I turned in. I also gave the magazine all my research so that the folks there could see for themselves what I was up to when I took these liberties, so I'm not sure it's going to be worth your time to fact-check this. I've been open about all such discrepancies.
I hear you, but I think it's just policy to fact-check all the nonfiction pieces the magazine publishes. I've also already made a trip out there to check up on a few things in the essay because my friend was getting married and I knew this assignment was coming up. But really, I think they just want to make sure all the facts in the piece add up, especially since there are a lot of them and your claims sometimes get a little inflammatory, in a good way, of course. So could you help me out with that number?
All right. Well, from what I can remember, I got that number by counting up the number of strip clubs that were listed in the local Yellow Pages at the time of Levi's death. However, since that issue of the phone book was long gone by the time I started writing this, I found that pornography article that I gave the magazine so that they could check up on my estimate.
Thanks, John. Very helpful. Now, I guess that's where the discrepancy is because the number that's mentioned in the article is different from the number you're using in your piece.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's because I think the rhythm of 34 works better in that sentence than the rhythm of 31. So I changed it.
Ah, okay. Well, thanks for your time, John. I'll probably be checking back with you later on.
There we go. Jim Fingal and John DeGatta reading from the book The Lifespan of a Fact. And so, Jim, what did you think you were getting into here? You're supposed to be fact-checking. There is this backstory. Yeah, we might just cope with the inaccuracies with a disclaimer. What did you think your job was at that point?
Well, I mean, I think the task I was given was basically, I mean, you could almost think of it as similar to someone who's fact-checking a work of fiction, that it's you, whatever the writing is, whatever the author's intentions, the fact-checking job is fundamentally the same, where you find the anything that is you can confirm or find evidence for, or you know, check proper names, quotations, whatnot, and you know, fundamentally you come up with the same report, and then the question is what is done with that. So with the work I was doing, as I understood it, basically my report would, you know, hopefully some of it might, if I was able to catch something that John had missed, he might fix something, but otherwise, it was so the magazine itself could know, all of the discrepancies, you know, regardless of whether or not they published the essay as is.
And John, how far do you think you can go with your sort of poetic license to change the rhythm and meter in a particular piece, to change the facts, to give your writing a more pleasant meter? How could you go to 64? Could you go to 104? 10,000? You know,
I think it's a good question, but I also think that line is determined by the writer, him or herself. What the issue that's raised in this book and by the controversy that the kind of controversy that gets stirred up whenever a memoir is revealed to have, you know, massaged some of someone's own personal history is is that we all seem to want to believe that writers within the big umbrella term of nonfiction are all following the same rules, that a memoirist is expected to follow the same rules as a journalist. Whereas I, at least as a reader, am not turning to a memoir for the same reason I'm turning to journalism. In fact, I want them to be quite separate experiences for me. So I don't need that, for me as a reader, I don't need that same level of trust when I'm in a memoir that I do in journalism. So partly this is an issue that has to do with labels, which has come up in this controversy, but it also has to do with the writer getting to know his or her subject well enough that he or she knows where the line is and what, you know, what can be crossed and what shouldn't.
But that's going to lead to questions about the reader's trust level with the writer and how you develop that bond so that the reader has the right to sort of give that license or not. And we will talk more about that when our conversation continues on The State of Things Today, talking about the lifespan of a fact with authors John DeGatta and Jim Fingal on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the new book, Lifespan of a Fact. In 2005, John DeGatta sent an essay to The Believer magazine. Jim Fingal had been assigned the task of fact-checking. Their correspondence became the material for the book. Jim, how long did it take you to fact-check John's essay?
Well, for the working at The Believer, I think the bulk of the fact-checking took place over a period of about 6 months, and then as revisions to the essay came in, it sort of stretched out over the course of a year.
And it developed into a 100-page document, is that right?
Yeah, so I think I had never particularly been trained on how fact-checkers were supposed to do their job, but the way that I figured out how to do it that worked for me was to take a Word document or whatnot of a piece I was working on, and sort of bold the factual assertions or the quotations that I could confirm, and sort of chop out the middle bits, and sort of in line provide my report of the sources that I found, things that confirmed or disputed things, and I would, you know, include in that document emails that I had sent or correspondence with the author. And that went from, I can't remember the original length of the essay, I think it was something like 10 to 15 pages, and that turned into about the 100-page document.
And, of course, John has sent you documentation that backs up the facts and the things. So you're looking at that documentation, checking it against your own, and then what you're writing is this report that includes, well, John said this in the essay, here's the backup, and here's what I found. So it's starting to get bulky, right? So then, John, how did you feel when the editor of The Believer shows you a 100-page document about your, 15 or 20-page essay?
I was I was surprised because as you mentioned, the essay had started at Harper's and it had actually gone through its own fact checking there, and I doubt Harper's would want me to reveal this, but Jim's fact checking was alarmingly more thorough than Harper's ever was. So I was surprised. First of all, I was certainly angry because I knew what I was in for. I knew the battle that was coming up. I was embarrassed, but I was also, at the risk of sounding perverse, I was also delighted because I thought the document, first of all, was amazing. I thought it was as brilliantly obsessive about trying to nail down these facts as I was, you know, apparently completely indifferent to them. But I also thought that in contrast to my essay, to the essay that Jim was fact-checking, it was a document that was an astounding illustration of this very issue, of the conflict between the facts that some readers want and expect from a so-called nonfiction text, and the liberties that some nonfiction writers feel that they need to take in order to create more deeply truthful experiences.
So when did it occur to one of you that this document itself could become the grist for a book?
I think it was when the editor we were working with, and Jim may want to correct me if my memory's wrong. But
Jim's happy to correct you, it turns out.
He is. I think at one point the editor we were working with was trying to figure out how to print the essay, but also give a nod to readers that it was woefully inaccurate. And she had suggested, I think at one point, printing the essay in the magazine and then giving a note that if readers wanted, they could read the fact-checking online and that there would be this, you know, dual reading experience. Mm-hmm. And I think it was that idea of giving readers both the accurate story, the fact-checking, and my inaccurate essay that seemed intriguing.
And the fact is that this book is a dramatization of your correspondence. These are not quotes. These are not actual emails.
Yeah, that's correct.
That is correct. Some are, but right. Not all of our conversations happened over email. Some of them mm-hmm. happened over the phone. Some at one point, Jim visited me in Iowa, and we didn't have a stenographer there with us. So there was a necessary element of reconstruction, but there was also a necessary element of reshaping, because even if we had printed out all of our emails, I'm pretty sure that most readers wouldn't want to read a facsimile of our conversation, because our conversation was not as, dare I say, as elegant as the conversation is in the book. You know, it happened over a long period of time, and it didn't naturally follow, you know, an argumentative arc the way that this book does. So when we started thinking about turning it into a book, we acknowledged that it needed to be a book, which is to say it needed to be a good reading experience.
Well, let me ask Jim, forgive me for interrupting, but I do want to hear from Jim about this, about adopting a persona and sort of recasting this book, dramatizing it. I mean, is that a kind of a concession to the fact that fact-checking and facts themselves make for bad reading and maybe we should do away with them? Jim?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's not so much a concession that that it has to be one way or another, but I guess an exploration of into the complexities of the topic, and you know what in sort of framing this deep detailed conversation about the sorts of disclaimers authors need, or the level of accuracy that they should have, and the reader's expectations. In framing that itself in an ambiguous structure, it seemed to get more at and mm-hmm. and have the reader get to have the experience with those sorts of complicated texts through reading our book, as well as reading just about those sorts of texts.
And you disclosed that up front, so I know what I'm doing. I wonder, as a reader, I understand what's going on. Could I ask you guys to read another section for us?
Sure. Okay, so this is the Sergeant Dominguez section. So the quote that we were checking, that I was checking against in the book, was, it was to Sergeant Tirso Dominguez, therefore, an officer at the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's Office of Public Information, that I turned for information about Las Vegas suicides. But I don't have a comment about anything like that, is how Sergeant Dominguez responded to my request for information. And then my my checking documentation reads, Sergeant Dominguez's name and rank are confirmed in the Las Vegas Weekly article Still Homeless for the Holidays by Damon Hodge, December 6, 2001, and there is evidence of John having spoken to Dominguez in his notes. However, the closest I can find to this quote is the following. I just don't want to be a part of a story about a kid who jumped off the stratosphere. Same general idea, but John is still playing around with the guy's words. I think it's clear upon reading below in the piece that John's trying to use the no comment line to play off what the CDC has to say about that. In other words, he's manipulating what this guy actually said in order to create a literary effect, which apparently is allowed among writers of John's non-journalistic literary genre, for which he apparently writes all the rules.
I'm not sure how I can say this so that you understand, Jim, because it doesn't seem to be getting across to you. But one more time for the record. I am not a journalist. I'm an essayist, okay? And this is a genre that has existed for a few thousand years. Ever heard of Cicero? So these rules that I'm working under are not mine, but rather were established by writers who recognized a difference between the hard research of journalism and the kind of inquiry of mind that characterizes the essay. An inquiry that's propelled by lots of different sources simultaneously, including science, religion, history, myth, politics, nature, and even the imagination. So there's a bit more freedom in essaying than there is in reportage.
Since I have five more sections to go, maybe you could help me out, as I'm still a little foggy on the rules. Basically, it sounds like you're saying that an essayist can write things with arbitrary truth value and make quotations out of whole cloth that are attributed to real people who live in the real world. Is that right? And if so, isn't that what people call fiction?
Have I changed the meaning of anything here, Jim? No, I've just streamlined this quote in order to help things move along a little better and to create a bit of resonance with neighboring paragraphs. It's what writers do.
Okay, so now I understand. The rules are, there are no rules as long as you make it pretty.
That's a pretty BS interpretation of what I just said.
I thought you were the great defender of people's rights to interpret.
There we go, Jim Fingal and John DeGatta reading from The Lifespan of a Fact. What about that? John, you free to make up the rules just to make it pretty? Let me ask you again.
I would answer the same way that one, I'm not a journalist, and I think that essayists do have to stand up for a 3,000 if not longer history of essayists being not really that concerned with accuracy, but concerned instead with an inquiry into an idea.
But when you make an inquiry, aren't we sort of stuck with structures that occur to us that present themselves as one thing or another? So if I were to say, you know, I've been to Las Vegas, and what I noticed, they don't like to talk about suicide. Ask any cop, ask any hooker, ask any dealer. The minute the story turns to suicide, they clam up. All right, there's Frank, goat waxing, whatever, philosophic, and he's making you think about it. And then if I were to say, in fact, if you look at the police manual, the instruction manual for the police in Las Vegas, they are instructed never to talk about suicide. If I said that, prefacing it with, in fact, if you look in this manual, and it wasn't there, that's a different expectation. My setup for that fact was far different than the expectation that I gave in my sort of essay kind of gestalt feeling about suicide. And don't you think those are fundamentally different things, and that the expectation of the reader changes because of the presentation of that particular information?
I think absolutely the expectation of the reader is key. And I think that actually the essay plays with that expectation, and that's possibly what has made some people upset, that they feel maybe toyed with. But I would say that the essay very loudly announces that it itself doesn't trust the facts that it has presented to the reader. There's a section, the penultimate section, in the essay starts questioning a rather crucial fact, which is, how many seconds it took Levi Presley's body to fall to the pavement, whether it was 9 seconds or 8 seconds. And it comes to this moment where it it signals, I think, very loudly to the reader by saying, you know, I may point to something that seems like it's significant, but there is the possibility that nothing real is there. And then it's immediately followed by a quote from T.S. Eliot that says, sometimes we misplace knowledge for the sake of information. That's a paraphrase, basically. Sometimes we lose the forest for the trees. That there are other ways of getting at some of these questions. And at that point, I would hope some readers at least would start realizing that what the essay's been attempting to create is actually an atmosphere, a mood. That is the best way that I could explain why I think this is happening in Las Vegas. I feel something when I go to that city. But that thing that I feel isn't verifiable. There's no way that Jim, you know, having taken that trip to the city, could verify my feeling. All I can do is, to use the word you raised earlier in the hour, is give as honest a depiction of what I feel and hope that the reader will trust that I'm being honest about my feeling.
But isn't writers have dealt with that and been convincing about that for years, and they write novels and they write short stories in ways that convey truth that is greater than journalism. In many, many cases, people have quoted great novels and great short stories to get at a deeper truth that the journalists seem to have missed. Why not write a novel?
I think that's a excellent question also, but I think that that raises a troubling question too, which is the insistence we seem to have that fact and fiction are absolutes, that, you know, fact is fact and fiction is fiction, and when in reality, at least my experience of them, as many people have spoken to this point as well recently, is that there, if anything, poles between which there are great variations and a great deal of room for negotiation. I understand the appeal for those absolutes because they're comforting, and I understand the appeal for that sort of certainty, but I don't mean to raise the conversation into the stratosphere, but my understanding is that we aren't a culture that actually believes in absolutes. My understanding of our history is that we've actually gone to war because we don't believe in absolutes. But the peculiar thing about this is that when it comes to literature, and in particular nonfiction, we are all for absolutes. In fact, we'll insist on them. Whereas art seems to be most fascinating when it exists in between those absolutes, because it's when art invites us or lures us or, dare I say, tricks us to enter into that terrain that we are more able to see things that perhaps we aren't regularly able to acknowledge or recognize in our everyday lives when we're living in those absolutes.
Well, let me ask you about the epigraph to this book, allegedly spoken by Lao Tzu. True words are not beautiful. And I read this and I thought, oh, that's wonderful, because it really can be taken two ways. True words are not beautiful, meaning, on the one hand, if you want to have a beautiful artifact, if you want to write beautifully, the truth could get in the way of that beautiful meter or rhyme. On the other hand, it might also mean that truth, if you want to get to the truth, it ain't pretty. And sometimes we've got to use some nasty meter and some pretty ugly, hefty data to get at a truth we may not want to know. Which way do you take that?
Which way do I take?
That epigraph, what does it mean to you? Does it mean we can manipulate the truth so that we have a beautiful artifact in the essay, because the meter is better, as with 34, or do we sometimes have to use clumsy language because the truth requires it?
Well, I'd like to hedge the question and say I want it both ways, which is why we included two epigraphs and the other side of Lao Tzu's statement.
Beautiful words are not true.
Right.
Let me ask you, Jim, I've only got about 30 seconds left, but I wonder how this whole process has changed you and your understanding of this sort of fact and fiction and where it all meets.
Well, it's mostly caused me to, I guess, complicate my picture of, I guess, this concept of genre and the reader's expectations, and think, I think as in the metaphor John illustrated, in terms of continuums rather than absolutes, and sort of see the genres of nonfiction or fiction as these sort of circles that we draw around different types of writings, but that are historically determined, you know, could be interpreted in different ways by readers versus writers. So I think it's just an interesting ground to explore, which the book tries to do to try to navigate that terrain.
It does indeed, and I'm happy to have explored it with you. Thank you both so much. Jim Fingal co-wrote the book. The book is The Lifespan of a Fact. John DeGatta is the author and editor. He teaches creative writing at the University of Iowa. Coming up next, I'm joined by a neuroscientist from Duke who studies the intersection of emotion and memory. We'll talk about how memories are not always reliable, where truth, fact, and fiction meet, mingle, and sometimes part company. All that on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We've been talking this hour about the book The Lifespan of a Fact. Lays out two sides of an argument. One side, John DeGatta, gives voice to the artistic license involved in constructing a narrative. The other side, Jim Fingal, meticulously tracking down the facts. Both are in search of the truth. And over the course of the book, Jim asks John for evidence of certain events, experiences that he writes about. John says there is no evidence. He's pulling from his memory. Well, joining me now is Dr. Allison Adcock, a neuroscientist and psychiatrist at Duke University. Her work explores the intersection of motivation, emotion, and memory. Allison Adcock, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about the difference. I mean, how confident can we be that what we perceive as the truth and remember as the way it happened is truly what is the truth and what really happened out there in the big wide world?
Yeah, I think the answer is not very confident. I mean, there are mismatches at many levels. Our brain isn't really designed to make veridical representations of the world. It's designed to extract relevant information and to make models that predict the future, which is very different from accuracy, right? And in my lab, we study the brain systems that are specialized to create these mental world models and that are also essential to creating these autobiographical memories, these sort of rich parent snapshots of experience that we, you know, we call memories. And for both kinds of memory traces, it's very clear from a variety of lines of research, including ours and others, that these processes are constructions. These memories are constructions. They're filtered from the get-go. And they're continually revised by later experience and even later retrieval or access of those memories. So memory making is really a dynamic process.
And how important is emotion, the way we feel about the event as it happened, to making that memory and building that image, that construction?
Yeah. Well, it might be useful to make a slight distinction between emotion and motivation. They're related, and we consider emotion, but we're really primarily concerned with what is remembered and why, and how wanting to remember things might actually change your ability to remember something. And the first thing to say, which I sometimes forget to say, is that it does, which sounds obvious. We all talk about it like it's true. You know, he remembers what he wants to remember. But it actually hadn't been demonstrated experimentally until we did it. And part of the reason I think that hadn't happened is that it's hard to motivate other people, and it's even harder to tell if you've done it successfully. But we now actually have tools to measure motivation. We can look inside the brain and look at brain responses to a sign saying, you know, you could win $5, instead of just assuming that sign motivates someone. And so usually what we do in our lab is we induce a motivated state like desire or dread, and then we ask people to learn something new. And we find that desire is a better learning motivator than dread for some kinds of learning, especially when it comes to learning details and accuracy. But if what you want to do is create a cartoon-like representation of a bus, for example, that generates a behavioral imperative like don't step into the street, then, you know, a bright line like that, extreme arousal, and that kind of motivated state is really good for that kind of memory formation.
So let me get this straight. If I have a more detailed memory, a more accurate and detailed memory of of something if I'm feeling good about it. But fearfulness gives me a more caricatured vision of what
happened. That's right. That's right. That's how things are looking. And I think you can understand why this might be if you're thinking about motivation to obtain something, to search for food, to forage. You know, the kinds of representations that might be formed in that state are representations that could support exploration and foraging and finding things, right? It's sort of interrogative behavior, searching behavior. And for that, you might need detail, but for other kinds of behavior, you don't.
And the kind of detail, too, is interesting because you may need to know that the tree is big and the lion is strong. But you don't need to know how tall the tree is. I mean, that's something that's kind of new to us, the actual measurement and the length of the tooth in the lion.
That's right.
Not
That's
so important
right.
if you're
probably,
running.
Yeah, but you probably do need to know where the tree is if it's got fruit in it that you want later, right? And so that kind of, you know, where is it and how is it related to other things and how you got there, the route that you took and how it's relating to the landscape is probably enhanced by wanting something.
And wanting to stay alive is an important part. So all of these become the ultimate motivations for us. And biologically, we assume that's why we make memories. It's all
right. That's right. Our memory systems probably didn't evolve so that we could win arguments about, you know, who was at so-and-so's wedding.
Right.
They evolved for helping us navigate the world, which is constantly changing. So the idea that the memories are updated and dynamic, even though it's a little distressing for those of us that like to rely on facts, is probably a really good thing.
Well, what do you mean updated and changed? I mean, can you really do that? That's dynamic and it's updated, meaning the fact I had in my head gets replaced by something different?
Absolutely. Every time you access your memories, you make them live again and modifiable. And it's very well understood that retrieving pieces of memories and not other pieces of those memories. So, for example, you think about the food that you had in an event and not the company that you had while you were there will strengthen the memory of the food, but not the memory of the other people at the party, and that memory will get weaker. So every time you access the information, it changes.
How this is kind of scary stuff in a way, to think that
it's
that
really scary.
Your whole world is really in your head and you're kind of wondering how much is actually out there.
Yep.
And certainly anybody who's been married for any length of time knows that you and your spouse are living in two whole different worlds whenever
That's
you talk
right.
about.
That's right. And the suspicion that you have that your spouse is, you know, remembering things that he or she wants to remember is probably right, you know, but it started at the very beginning before the memory even existed. And I think thinking about this shift is particularly distressing for people, you know, scientists, many of them, like me, who grew up as accuracy junkies. You know, that was the sort of era of the Time Life book. I was really enamored with facts about breeds of dogs and kinds of stars and specific patterns of brainwaves and whatever, but also my ability to get those things into my memory and remember them and have them as, you know, the truth about the world. And of course, as we learn more about how our memories are really beautifully distorted, I've had to sort of abandon that addiction. So I think this shift has pieces in it of both John and Jim. I feel like they're sort of the angel and devil on my shoulders. But the trauma of realizing how wrong you can be is also, so like John, I take a really perverse delight in awareness of these inaccuracies because it's a relief to realize that what we have to do is just reality check over and over and over again. And by so doing, we can actually make our memories more accurate.
What does that do for you as a scientist, though, to know that memory is so fundamentally unreliable in the way that a scientist would like it to be more reliable?
Well, I think, as I said, that, you know, the science tells us that we have to measure things, right? We measure the inaccuracies, we measure how wrong we are, and we also, one thing that we do in science habitually that we don't do so much in, you know, in everyday life is measure our certainty. You know, we really quantify that, and we don't do that so much when we talk to each other. We just assume that the best thing is to be accurate and right, and if we're not doing that, then it's somehow an embarrassment, instead of acknowledging that all of this uncertainty exists and coping with it.
And how would you cope? I mean, again, I'm thinking about what John said. Look, there was a feeling that I had about Las Vegas. That's the thing I needed to convey. I used a few facts to kind of bolster that feeling to make an accurate representation, not of the number of strip joints in Las Vegas. That was irrelevant. How I felt about that and its relevance to the suicide, that was the important thing. Can we have a science? Is there a way to sort of convey the world with our Western sense of fact and fiction that would work? What would that look like?
Well, I think this is a really deep question. You know, it's related to narrative and simplification and model building of all sorts. You know, in science, what we're trying to do as humans is build models of the world that will help us understand it, right? But in order to do that, we actually have to simplify the world, because the most accurate, best model of the world is the world itself. It's as detailed as the world is, but that doesn't help us understand anything. It's, you know, as complex as we started out with. So we actually have to simplify things and reduce them to their essential properties or features of them in order to make any sense of them. And I think, you know, for accuracy junkies like me, that can feel like lying, you know, in a really fundamental way. But the relationship I've come to with respect to this kind of fundamental complexity and unknowability is not nihilism, that we should just stop trying, but that we're just always wrong, and our job is to figure out how we're wrong, and that's how to do science and be a human.
It also seems to me that knowing when to apply the data and when to apply the feeling is key to this. I mean, for instance, if I were to ask you how many foot pounds of pressure it would take you to stop your car to press against your brake pedal 30 feet away from a stop sign at 30 miles an hour, you couldn't answer. Doesn't mean I won't get in a car with you, because I know you know how to stop your car. I've asked the wrong question, in a sense. What I need to do is get in the car with you and see if you know how to drive.
That's right. And a big part of science is figuring out how to ask answerable, relevant questions that for which data matters. And a lot of what we do in science and the model building that we do, and that relies on these same memory systems that create our autobiographical memories, is to formulate good questions and simplify the answers to generalize to something else. But, you know, the system is really about making predictions. And one experimental result that I think is really useful for thinking about this: if you ask people to learn a game in which a face of a person has a preference. So, for example, you like pork barbecue and sweet tea, and then I learn that somebody, and you prefer pork barbecue to beef and sweet tea to unsweet tea, and then I learn that another person has the same preference about pork versus beef barbecue. If I ask people, well, does that person like sweet or unsweet tea, they'll answer the question as quickly as if they had already studied that and had become aware of it, because we're really good at making these generalizations, which is inaccurate, right? If you look at the accuracy, they didn't have that experience, but they are still able to use it.
So how has all of this research affected your own personal memories or the way you perceive memory?
Well, as I said, I've had to give up a little bit of the delight in, you know, what I can record and how seemingly true it is about the world and my attachment to truth. But I also am relieved by the idea that the memories can be something more closer to narrative, right? That I value them for the feelings that they generate, or the connection to other people that they represent, to the stories that they represent, and it's hard not to believe them, but I try to have a different relationship with them and not be so stubborn when faced with other people's accusations that I'm misremembering something.
From the clinical standpoint, the way we remember, the way we perceive ourselves, I suspect our narrative about ourselves, our identity, has to do with an accumulation of memories. Well, go ahead, because I wonder to what extent that is psychiatric disorder, a misremembering of things or a holding on to something that needs to be let go of.
It is the bread and butter of adult psychiatry. You know, over and over again, we are attached to these narratives. And the really striking thing is that we're so attached to them, we enshrine them, even if they're really painful. Things like, everyone I love will eventually leave me. People go out of their way to collect information and to confirm those kinds of beliefs in a way that demonstrates how valuable the narratives and the illusion of predictability about the world is, because, you know, it seems clear that the smart thing to do, right, the adaptive thing to do, would be to discard that if it's not true, but we don't do it. We don't learn. We fail to learn over and over again.
We don't do that in Western society. That is this fact-driven society, which is a fairly new phenomenon, a few hundred years old, give or to, depending on how far back you want to go or who you want to say started all this, versus a society that lives on narrative, that storytelling and the elasticity and dynamism involved in storytelling is precisely how they adapt. Have we become a little sicker because we're a little more attached to the facts?
I don't see any evidence that our attachment to the facts is making it easier for us to give up on our narratives. It just makes us more conflicted about them. Right?
Well, I would think it would be harder to give up the narrative.
Yeah, that's right. I think it is harder to. I don't know. I don't do clinical practice in any other culture besides our own. But I do think that the attachment to accuracy causes pain when we discover that we're being obstinate or not looking at, you know, the idea about denial is that you're not letting yourself see things. And that may be complicated by this sort of insistence on accuracy in our view of the world.
So is it possible for us to tell the scientific narrative, the story of the world, in narrative form? Can we drop some of the facts and figures and get back to creation myths? Try to do this, and people say they're silly, but then you look back and think, well, that's not a bad way to explain how you got here.
Well, you know, the creation myth for my culture is about knowledge and what it means, right? Eve ate a bite of an apple of the tree of knowledge because she wanted the apple. She wanted the knowledge. She wanted the snake to go away. I don't know what she wanted, but that was the fundamental defining moment. You know, the acquisition of knowledge that changed her relationship to her world. Right.
Well, the knowledge of good and evil. So it was establishing a polarity where before there may have been none. It's kind of an interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
So where do we take this? Where is your research going? What are you looking at the moment?
Well, we're interested in really isolating what motivation is, what kinds of flavors of motivation there are, and how they impact the memory that's formed when we're learning. And, you know, even though I talk a lot about matching the kind of motivation to the kind of behavior that's evoked, the one that we're most interested in is dopamine, which is released during desire or anticipation of good things happening, and seems to be associated with more with accuracy and being able to tell the truth from illusion. So in thinking about this interview and the kinds of things that we've been discussing here today, I realize that I'm probably still looking to improve my own accuracy because that's the one that we're most interested in. But we do it most of the time with behavioral cues, you know, promising people things or threatening them. But we've also there are drugs that induce these states, but we're really trying to understand how to elicit them with behavior and even teach people to do it for themselves.
Well, Allison, I don't care how accurate you've been today. You tell a great story.
And it was a pleasure.
And I'm assuming there's a great deal of accuracy as well. Thank you. Dr. Allison Adcock. Adcock is a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist at Duke University. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Megan Modafferi is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.